you want to develop these that will remove the roar from the hive. And bees that will tolerate or live with a large number of varroa, a high population of varroa. If you're going into a hive, or if you've got a sticky board and you're seeing 1.5 to 2 mites per hour drop from natural drops on that sticky board, but your bees don't die from it, the bees will survive that, but they won't be productive. And what you'll find, they'll tolerate a large number of mites in the hive. They'll live with it. But the more mites that are in the hive, the more bacterial and viral problems they will vector into the hive. And you'll start seeing these, it used to be called parasitic mite syndrome. But now it's mistakenly called European foul brood. A lot of people that see European foul brood, what they're calling that in the spring, what it is actually, it's a foul brood, but it's not European and it's not American because the larvae are too big. European foul brood kills a larva in a seed stage. 4 days, 4.5 days, it kills it. American foul brood kills the pre-pupa. The cell is already capped. But this sort of brood disease that you'll see, the larva will be laid out long ways in the cell, like it's trying to crawl out of the cell. And it used to be associated with parasitic mite syndrome, and it is a bacterial problem that's vectored into the hive by varroa mites. If you're going to breed around that, that's pretty tough. It's because you're working with bees that, number one, are going to be really stressed because of this bacterial problem in the hive. And number two, there's a reason that it's there. They live with too many varroa in the hive. They don't remove the varroa. They just learn to survive with a smaller population of bees in the hive. And those hives, a lot of times, don't make it through the winter, too. Yes?
I heard a part about snotty brood.
That's it. That's what it is. It's got so many slang names, some of them not even repeatable.
There's no odor to it, is there?
Oh, there's no odor to it. It don't string out like AFB, but the larva is way too old to be European. And the first sign that you'll see of it, now you'll see some that is the right age to be killed at European that's dead. It'll be kind of yellowish brown. But most of it, the first sign you'll see of it, it looks like, you know, when you see a larva, it should never be anything other than pearl. And if the head starts coming up over the tail end of it like that, that's the first sign you'll see of it. It'll be a 5-day larva, or maybe a 6, that the head is coming up over the tail of it, curling past the tail. And some of the later stages, it will actually curve like a corkscrew, and it's like the larva is trying to crawl out of the cell. What's happening, the larva is starving. And see, that's what happens with American foul brood and European foul brood. The bee in that last stage starves to death because it's got this bacterial infection in its midgut that's consuming all of the food that the bee takes in. And with the case of American foul brood, there's nothing left in there for the pre-pupa to eat in that capped cell. With European foul brood, the nurse bees quit feeding. They say, the heck with this. This thing ain't growing a bit. We're feeding it twice as much as the rest of them. And they quit feeding it. And it dies. Well, this larva is big enough that when it gets to the stage where they're not feeding it anymore, it can actually try to crawl out of the cell. And sometimes it almost makes it out. I mean, you see them kind of hanging over the cell a little bit. But someday somebody will name it something. But it used to be associated just with parasitic mite syndrome. But parasitic mite syndrome was that accompanied with a bunch of other brood diseases like chalk brood. And that was the classic. You would see European foul brood, chalk brood, sack brood, stone brood, all of that, all on the same frame. Well, now you just see this snotty brood, whatever you want to call it. You just see that, and it's kind of separated itself out. But that's mostly because the sac brood and stone brood are both viral problems. And once that virus runs its course, it's out of there. It has to be reinfected into the hive for it to repeat. Well, the varroa that carried that are out of the hive. But the bacterial infection keeps rolling on its own once it starts. And paramycin will knock it out. I mean, just in one treatment, one application, paramycin will knock it out, which indicates that it's a pretty new thing, because European foul brood takes 3 treatments to knock it out. Yeah. And American foul brood is pointless.
I think we got that last fall, and I had a package that we installed this year that has the same thing.
Yeah.
So do you do the paramycin as a powder on the top?
On the end bars, right across the end bars. Don't put paramycin out in the middle of the hive, because if it gets down on brood cells, it'll kill them too. And yeah, I've done that too. Yes, sir.
Will paramycin and patty for soup treat do the job?
Paramycin and patty is consumed slower than what you put across the end bars. What you put across the end bars, they don't actually eat it, but they carry it out of the hive. And they, in the process of getting it out of the hive, it kind of gets it on the larva. And they groom it off of one another, and that's how they actually ingest it. And then they feed larva, and that's how the larva ingest it. But the patty is consumed, a patty or sugar syrup, bees tend to store liquid, but remove solid, either remove or consume solid. So if you put it in syrup, they'll probably store it. The paramycin breaks down and you don't get any use out of it. If you put it in the patty, they consume it slower than you need them to. If you sprinkle it across the end bars, they'll get rid of it within 2 or 3 days. And it'll take care of the problem. It's amazing how fast the hive will turn around that has that brood problem. And within a matter of a week and a half, it won't look like the same hive. The paramycin will actually fix the young larva. It'll actually, the ones that are off-colored will survive, but the ones that have already started to twist won't. The bees will remove them. And upcoming larvae won't be affected by it. But if you're grafting or making queens from a hive, don't use an off-colored larvae. Yes?
Can you put that on the frame of the year?
Yeah.
Pretty well take care of that.
Well, you can put it on at any time, really. You can put it on in the spring. You don't want to put it on a hive that you're making honey on. If honey supers are on the hive and they're foraging and they're putting nectar in those honey supers, you don't want to put it on that hive.
Like before the flow starts coming in, where you can put it on,
yeah,
on the boxes.
Yeah, and because it will stop it so quick, I mean, it's a 1 week turn, so it's not going to be in there for very long. So it's, yeah, you put it on the spring of the hive or spring of the summer, spring of the year on a hive. You can put it on in the summer after you take honey off. On a hive that usually these hives aren't going to be that productive anyway. So if it's got this problem very bad, then it's better just to take the honey supers off, get this thing healthy to go through the winter, and go next year.
You don't feed them at all, whether they recover.
They will eventually recover if they make it through the winter. This last winter, that was the if. There's not many of them that went into the fall with this problem that made it through the winter, if any. At my house, I'm talking about. I see it all the time. I don't do anything to our bees that we're raising queens out of. I don't do anything to the ones that I'm going to use to sell builders. I don't do anything to the ones that I'm going to graft out of. The drone yards are a different story. If it's a drone or a honey production yard, I have to do something to knock the varroa population down, and the drone yards or the bees will pull all the drones out. I mean, that's their method of taking care of varroa pressure, is to remove the pupa that the varroa is infesting. And since drone pupa is way more attractive for varroa mites, most of the drones get removed if I don't do something to knock the varroa population down. If you're not wanting to use a chemical method, you can take a garden sprayer with sugar syrup in it and just drizzle it between the frames, just sugar syrup, drizzle it between the frames of the brood nest, and that will start a hyper-grooming activity that the bees will groom themselves until they groom all the varroa mites. They groom, you know, they don't stop until everybody's hair is combed. And the varroa mites are out of the hive if you've got a screen box. If you've got solid bottoms, you have to do something that will actually kill the varroa. And the least toxic of things that would actually kill the varroa, somewhat effective hop guard. You can use that with Honey Super Zone. Mite Away Quick Strips, you can use that with Honey Super Zone. The Mite Away Quick Strips are really, really temperature sensitive. And in hot weather like we've been having, no way that I'd put one on a hive. It'll peel brood and run bees out of the hive. Now it works. It works if it empties the hive, obviously. You know, all the grower are dead. Bees are gone too, but no grower. But under the right conditions, Mite Away Quick Strip work really well. But they work a little too well when it gets up above 80, 85 degrees, especially if it's humid. But those are the two least toxic methods that actually kill varroa. The thymol treatments are next in being least toxic, but you have to remove your honeysuckers if you're using those. After that, Apistan, the new, what's it called? Apivar, which is Amitraz. It's a pretty hard chemical, but it's not as hard as Kulafos. Checkmite still works, but it's a really harsh chemical. And any of those will get into the wax. That's why that I don't use anything in the hives that I'm going to graft out of. And that's where I see most of this weird brood, is in hives that I'm going to graft out of or use for cell builders. And I won't use a cell builder or graft from a hive that has it. Just don't take a chance. Yes, ma'am. Within your yard, it's not. It's an individual hive thing. It has to be vectored into the hive by the mites. And you have to have a significant population of mites in a hive before you'll see it. What I tell people is you can treat the cause or you can treat the symptoms. Treating the cause, you would do something to knock down the mite population. And in those hives, where I knock the mite population down, I don't see it hardly at all, very seldom. But in hives that I don't treat for the mites, I see a lot of it. And sometimes I will treat those hives with the paramycin. I treat the symptom, just to keep the hive alive and get it through the winter. I want hives as healthy as possible and as big as possible going into winter. And that's just because I'm a big fat guy and I like to eat, and I think everything ought to like to eat too. I like a lot of food, a lot of bees. Everything in our house is big and fat, and there's lots of it, you know. I think that if 12 laying hens is good, I want 120 of them. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a spray threshold? Like, if you touch the screen,
If I was going to recommend whether or not to treat for mites in the spring, are you using a spring bottom and a sticky board under it? One hive, one mite per hour drop, natural drop. That's the threshold. If you want to be even more conservative than that and kind of be a little more vicious about it, half that. One half mite per hour and treat. But one mite per hour and leave the board in there for 24 hours. If there's 24 mites on the tree. And if you're paranoid, then there's 12 on the tree. But you can set your own thresholds, but I wouldn't go over the one mite per hour. You know, if you're...
The following double that? Are you saying 2 hours?
No. Anytime, one mite per hour. And, you know, this beekeeping is... it's a really individual kind of thing. And, you know, there's some people that don't treat, and I don't treat our queen using hives. And there's some people that treat in a, just across the board, you know, everything. It's kind of like, I had one set of grandparents that I stayed away from them, like they had the plague. Until about June of every year to keep from getting castor oil. Because I went over to grandmama's house anytime between the spring equinox and the summer equinox, I was getting a dose of castor oil. And that's the way some people treat their bees. You know, everybody gets a dose of this because it's such and such date. And if you do that, that's okay. I mean, I'm not fussing on you or anything. It's just that this is so individual. If you want to set your threshold at a half of a mite per hour, that's fine. But if you set it over more than one mite per hour, natural drop, you're probably going to get overrun with mites. Because that's kind of the upper limit. Yes. I thought somebody raised your hand over here a while ago.
I've been checking my own cell for quite some time to see what the numbers are.
Yeah.
And I like doing that.
I do that a lot. I don't have many bottom screens, and I'm not organized enough to put sticky boards under there. The last sticky board I pulled out had a dead mouse on it. It had been there so long. But go ahead.
I've noticed there's a big difference the last few years, especially this year. Some of my hold on reading that have a lot less mites.
Yeah.
And some of the native stuff that bring up for the covering area seems like they've got a lot more.
Yeah.
Maybe years ago, I'm sorry, I'm not sure about it.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, I could catch it. Using the old and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, but your pole line is still staying relatively low. Yeah. Well, I mean that's a good indication of something that's working. I mean, it's not. Well, Russian bees do handle mite pressure a lot better than Italian bees, but. Obviously, so the pole line. They found them in the bushes a lot. One particular year of Russians, I had them for 4 years. I had a pure Russian yard that I kept 60 hives in for 4 years. And one particular year, man, I tell you, you just couldn't suit up good enough or quick enough. I got to putting the suit on in the house before I even went out to the yard. And it was probably 200 yards from the house.
They would start to build up, and then that you'd think, hey, I'm going to get a crop off of them.
Yeah.
They were gone. They had the honey with them. And
yeah.
And then the process would start over.
Yeah. My issue with brushing was that they missed the honey flow every year at our house. And the Russians typically began to build up on the same honey flow that Italians were storing as surplus. And then the honey flow stopped, the Russians stopped, we'd get another little flow, they'd be behind the eight ball. So that they were always working from just behind. And I just couldn't make the honey crop with them that I could with Italian-based bees like Minnesota Hygienics, or the whole lines would have done the same thing at that time. So it wasn't that I just didn't like Russians, or it wasn't that Varroa killed them or anything like that. They did pretty good without treating them, but they just didn't perform. They didn't produce like I wanted them to.
To this day, I can spot my son on Lenny's in there.
Yeah, yes, like that. Same thing with ours. One year they were really nice to work. The USDA version was really nice to work, but they managed to breed that out of them. So. But that's something that if you're breeding for gentleness, that's something you have to breed for every single generation. It's one of the most recessive traits in the genetic equation of honeybees is gentleness. You have to constantly select for gentle behavior. But that also comes from your drone side. So, you know, it's a little bit easier knowing that you don't have to have a gentle queen and a gentle drone if you just have all gentle drones. But still, there's those feral colonies out there. The only way around that is instrumental insemination. And I'm just not quite ready for that yet. I applaud anybody that gets involved with instrumental insemination. I've seen it done. I've seen it demonstrated. I've never really tried it myself because it's kind of like I've seen guys flying jet fighter planes off of aircraft carriers. I think, man, that would be really cool. That would be a rush. But I'm not quite ready for that myself. You know, I can picture a lot of bad things happening with instrumental insemination and with flying a jet fighter. Probably about the same results. I imagine both of them would crash. But the only way around feral bees is instrumental insemination, because I don't know anywhere around my house anyway that you could put a mating yard and not have a chance of at least some feral bees. And of course, you let your bees swarm every year, you'll finally kind of populate the area. I try not to let ours swarm.
Yes. I had experience with the buckfast, not the ones out of Texas.
The Canadian buckfast are a lot better bee than the ones out of Texas are. And the reason for that is that I used to have bees in northern Ontario about 4 years. I got to know a lot of the beekeepers up there and some of the breeders. And the buckfast that they have in Canada is the version before. I don't know how much you guys know about Brother Adam and the different races that he mixed together. One of the last additions, he was constantly adding different lines to what was a really good bee to begin with. And I always thought, man, why didn't he just quit when it was really good? But he was always trying to make the perfect bee instead of just a really good bee. And one of the last lines he added was a monocolon, which come from the monocolon mountains in Africa. And there's a lot of argument that the monocolon is actually just a strain of Scutellata, which is the African bee. And the argument is that it wasn't really understood at that time that in areas where Scutellata are at a higher altitude, there's a break in the brood cycle, just like it's a temperate region. And with that break in the brood cycle, you get a break in the drone population. with the break in the drone population, they have to start all over, and they work more like Italian bees than they do like African bees. They're not nearly as aggressive in a temperate region or at altitude. And that's the argument that it was misunderstood by Brother Adam that monopollens were actually scutellata at a higher altitude. But anyway, the Canadian version is of buckfast is the version before monopollen was added. So I used to have buckfast years and years ago, 25 years ago, before African bees were in Texas. And the buckfast were pretty nice bees to work at that time until they superseded. And if that hive superseded, the F1 buckfast was just as nasty gets. But when they superseded, it was always in the summer. You know, after there was a large drone population of buckfast out there to breed with. So the queens were mating with drones that were not very nice, that were buckfast, that had monocolon genetics in them. And I'm convinced that's probably why they were pretty ill to work. But the Canadian buckfast, they're not like that. The F1 Canadian buckfast were pretty good. And the originals are good too. But they're not the perfect bee. I mean, I'll go back to what I said earlier. Perfect bee is one that you're going to raise and continue to raise at your place. That's going to be the perfect bee for you. Because it's going to be acclimated to your forage and your climate. It's going to take 2 or 3 years to get there, maybe as much as 5, but you will get there eventually. Until you get there, do whatever it takes to keep them alive. You want to keep that strain going. Get the strain that does the best, that produces the best where you live, and then work on the different things that you want to add in there, like mite suppression and hygienic behavior, or whatever you want to work on after that. First get the bee that's going to be the most productive for you, because what good is a honeybee if it ain't making any honey or pollinating or whatever you want it to do. You get the bee you want first, it's going to produce, and then work on the other things after that. But buckfast is a good line to add. I mean, they're hygienic. The ones I've had experience with are hygienic. And so-so with mites. And they're not a perfect bee, but they're better than average. They're better than Cardone. Yes, sir.
Question, I guess, from all of you. Have you ever imported bees from Canada with buckfast honey? How are they shipping to you? Is that there in an import restriction?
We want to pick them up ourselves.
No, we pick them up.
Oh, isn't that illegal to bring them back
to
the States?
You can bring any kind of bee back to the United States as long as it does not have wax.
From Canada.
You can't bring wax back from Canada.
See, I've read that's where they run into problems. People stick the queen in the pocket.
We had the health papers and had to go through the
Department of Agriculture and everything.
Yeah, they're really strict with their inspections.
I've seen them advertise buckfast queen, but you can't order them and have them shipped to you.
Yeah, you can.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, you can. When I brought my bees back from Ontario, it was 2002, I think. Maybe 2003, but I was going across the border at Thunder Bay, between Duluth and Thunder Bay in Minnesota, and I went through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I had all the forms and everything already. I mean, if you're going to do that, go up there to get them. Whatever state you're coming into, you got to go through their Department of Agriculture and have all the forms already signed and signed off on before you go. But it was still quite an ordeal even in 2003 to get those bees, I had to trail a load of them. And evidently, they've not had any come across the border like that before, those particular border agents. And fortunately, I'd gone back and forth enough that I'd kind of established a relationship with several of the agents up there. And this one lady finally came up and said, well, I know him. That's that idiot from Kentucky comes up here and has bees. He's probably got bees on that trailer. And they said, well, that's what he said. Ah, paperwork's good. Let him go. So that was my saving grace after sitting there for about an hour and a half. But with them trying to get somebody in the Department of Agriculture of Minnesota to ask if that was the right paperwork. But yeah, you can get them back here from Canada. Canada is the only place that you can bring them across the border like that. You can't bring them across from Mexico. But buckfast is a good addition to put. Cordovans are productive and pretty, but they seem to be a little bit more tender than other bees. I used to joke that they woke up every day looking for a new way to die. But they've gotten a little bit better since since I used to make that joke a lot. But and the reason they've gotten better is because more breeders are raising them. And it's just a matter of the ones that didn't live, didn't pass their genetics on. It's not really any different than what you're going to find with your own breeding program. The best bees are going to be the ones that, I mean, the most likely to survive are going to be the ones that don't die off the winter. And some of them, you can't keep from dying in the winter. Even good bees. Under the right circumstances, any of them can perish. And not the fault of the beekeeper or the bees, just that's the way nature does it. That's why bees swarm 4 or 5 times a year in nature, because 2 or 3 of them are going to die. And that leaves some to perpetuate the species. So, number one, breed for what you want, know what you're getting. Use your own bees as much as you can. Swap among one another. I mean, right now I'd be inclined to try to find some pole lines. You know, because obviously, working for him. And use your most productive bees. Know your criteria that you're selecting for. Survive the winter. Start early, build quick. And then acclimate those bees to your area. And then start selecting for mite suppression or hygienic behavior or gentleness. For gentleness, you got to select every year. And for the first 4 or 5 years, keep them alive, whatever you got to do, with the thought that whatever you put in a hive is going to stay in that wax. And you're not going to get good queens out of a hive that has had coumaphos or fluvalinate or amitraz in it. You might get a few good ones. You won't get as good a percentage of them. Yes.
Hey, Ken, before you finish, can you, that I use it, your formula that you use for your fall queens for the sugar and the bee pro mix?
What, the patties?
Yeah, the patties. But that really works for us anyway, for fall queen logo.
I use that a lot. I mean, I use it on cell builders. Put it in cell builders. It makes a difference in the quality of cells that I get. And the formula is similar to, this patty is similar to the winter patty for that date ant cells. And the formula is 7 parts granulated sugar, 3 parts pollen sub, 1 part syrup. Now, the syrup has its own mixture. It's 1-to-1 sugar syrup for each quart. Put 3 tablespoons of honeybee healthy. And 7 parts granulated sugar, 3 parts pollen sub, You can use powdered pollen if you want to, just know where it comes from. One part syrup. And the syrup for each quart, 3 tablespoons of honeybee healthy. And if it's a little soupy, just mix a little bit more of the dry stuff with it. If it's not soupy enough. I put them on my cell builders, and it makes a difference in the quality of cells that I get. Now, one thing about it, if you have small hive beetles that are active in your yard, if they're active in the yard, don't put any protein in these bags. Substitute powdered sugar for the pollen sun. Small hive beetles won't bother the patty very much, if at all, unless there's protein in it. But if you put that protein in there, man, it is the perfect food to raise a bunch of beetles. And if anybody don't have beetles and you need some, come to the house.
Well, Randy Oliver made the comment once that he don't have small hive beetles in his yard, so he couldn't send them to him.
Yeah, that's one of those southern things where you follow that up with bless his heart.
Yeah.
Kent, do you, your 7 parts, 3 parts by volume or weight or what?
That's the reason that it's parts, it's by volume.
Volume.
So that you don't have to do a bunch of measuring or anything. You can make it a tablespoon. Using a tablespoon for the part size, or you can make it with a 5-gallon bucket for the part size. I usually make it up in a 5-gallon bucket, but I usually use about a quart and a half dipper that I have to get the stuff up.
The syrup, can you use hot corn?
Yeah, you can use high fructose corn syrup. I use whatever I've got. 1-1 syrup, high fructose corn syrup, 55, 42, anything liquid that's sweet is really the criteria. And the only reason that I make the syrup when I'm using granulated sugar and then 1-1 sugar syrup is just to be a carrier for the honeybee health. That's the only reason I make that up like that. I make this up in the kind of a wet biscuit dough, not the consistency of it.
I think you're the first nationalist speaker that I've heard that promotes honeybee healthy. Most of them say it doesn't do any good. What do you think it does?
Honeybee healthy mimics the nazinol pheromone. It does the same thing that lemongrass oil does. Whatever you put honeybee healthy in attracts bees to it. That's right. Your syrup won't mold or spoil either.
Another thing that I do then is I just cut a little 4-inch or 6-inch piece of newspaper square and just lay that and then put that mush right on top of it.
Yeah. You can put it on a little cheap paper plate or something like that. I worked with one fellow that's all he used was a bunch of cheap paper plates. Man, that's kind of wasteful. You can use newspaper for that. And he said, well, my hired hands, they won't go to the trouble of tearing newspaper apart. I can hand them a stack of these paper plates. He said, what they don't use, they take home, and at least they get the work done. But, yeah, any kind of paper, newspaper, wax paper, any kind of paper is fine if it's a little soupy to lay it on. But our bees, we have a couple hundred hives in South Mississippi. And down there, there's hardly ever more than 3 or 4 days in a row that they can't fly all during the year. And I feed them just granular sugar and all over the winter. I take a couple of 5-gallon bags and just lay them. This sounds pretty lazy, pretty silly too. I just lay the bag on top of the frame. When they get hungry, they'll chew through it. Once in a while in the spring, I'll find a mouse in one of those bags. And it's always a little rodeo there. You know, when find a mouse in the bag, because I'm going to throw it on somebody. But the guy that works with me, he's not scared of mice until they run up his britches leg. And he had one run up his britches leg once, and now he's terrified of it. So he's a lot of fun. But I don't know if that would work here or not, you know, putting just a bag of sugar on top of them, but it works really good down there. And it's pretty lazy, really, because I don't have to mix anything. I don't have to have any feeders or anything like that. I just lay it on top of the frames, put an empty super on top of it, let them go. And they're in good shape in the spring. Yes, ma'am.
Do you find that when you do it that way, it absorbs water better, and so it's still all over the bottom of the hive?
You know, the funny thing is, of course, if you lay it across the frames, you have the width of the frame that is blocking it. But when you take the bag up, there'll just be some little chewed out portions in between a couple of frames. And the bees will keep it from falling out and running out in the hive. They will propolize up in there and keep the honey, keep the sugar from running out in the hive. It's pretty interesting. I did that because it was raining one day and I was tired and I'd already been stung. All I wanted to be stung. We had a dozen hives in one little neck of a bee yard, and the guy that's working with me, my right-hand guy, Paul, he said, "Well, we got to do this." He was kind of grappling. "We got to do this in the rain." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're just going to lay the bags in there and say the heck with it and go home." Well, he was all for that, so that's what we did. And I really didn't know if it would work or not. I thought it would, but I didn't know. But I was really surprised when we went back the next spring and interested to see that they propolized underneath those bags. And it's almost like they made their own little spigot. When they wanted sugar, they just go up in there and get it. And the bags were still, I didn't think, when I opened the first top, I didn't think it took anything out of them, because the bags looked like they were all intact when you took them up. There's all these little cutouts in the bottom of the bags in. They'd eaten it all. They might not have eaten it all. Ants might have got in there and ate a lot of it, but I don't care who got fed, bees were alive and in good shape. I'll feed a few ants to have a good bee. Any other questions? I don't have any secrets about anything, so, you can ask. Yes?
You said you use a Breeder Queen hive to raise yourself. My question for you is, if you pull her out and open brood, you're taking bees with it, are you leaving enough nurse bees in there to raise yourself?
Yeah, because the hive is always a big hive to begin with, because I want to raise queens out of the hive that has done the best.
But now when you graft and put the cell bars in there, are they going to use them, or are they going to use them odd pockets of eggs on them?
No, there won't be any eggs in there, because I take all that out and put it with the old
queen. A lot of your queens will have, like you said, the spotty ears. She'll come back and lay eggs in.
Yeah, sometimes the first graft that I have, I go back in 6 days, and that's the first day that you'll have a pretty good chance of all your cells being capped, and I pull the cells on the day six. And once in a while, I'll go back in, and there won't be any cells in there at all on my bar, but there'll be 8 or 10 on the, on those odd cells. I just tear it. Well, if they're good, I cut them out and steal them. I'm still not arrogant enough to think I can make a better queen than they can. But if they're just little bitty peanut cells, I'll tear them out and graft again. That next graft is always a really good one.
Even after 6 days?
Oh, yeah, even after 6 days. Because I'm leaving all the foragers in there, plus most of the capped brood. And usually it's a double D, and I condense all that down into a single D to make them crowded, and all the foragers are continually coming and going, bringing food back and forth, and I put the patties on too, so that there's food there even if they have a few rainy days that foragers can't
pour.
I usually put four bars. I have 17 for the bar on average, so it's about 50, roughly 50 cells. 50 to 60, something like that.
In each deep.
Yeah. And I don't use a frame that has the cutouts, you know, that you slide the bars in. I put the bars in between the frames. I just take four of those graph cut bars and pinch them in between the frames, just below the top bar. And that way, see, when you have that solid frame, the bees have to festoon under the cell to work on, so it takes more bees. But if you pinch them in between the frames, bees can work on the cell from the side of each frame, so they don't festoon under them.
Pull them apart, you
have to be careful. Yeah, you have to be careful. Most of the time, they don't wax the cell in there, though. Yeah, most of the time, they won't wax the cell in there, but once in a while, you'll find a couple of them that they will. Yeah, so they haven't had that much. If you left them in there and there was a honey flow going, man, it'd be bad. Yeah, they would. They'd wax them all in there. But
put four of them. Would you start like right in the middle?
Yeah.
And work four right in the center.
Uh huh. Okay. And that's all about there again. It's all about the heat transfer, heat regulation.
So any bees in the super, you just shake them out or drive them
mm-hmm.
out?
Yep. Shake all the bees out of the super.
That's the best idea for a cell wall.
Well, you know, that's a starter finisher, and I'll be the first person to admit. You won't get as many perfect cells out of it as you will by putting them in a starter and then moving them to a finisher. You won't get these full frames of, you know, all perfect, great big cells, but you'll get plenty of cells. And with me, it's a numbers game. If I know that I'm going to get, if I know I've got 17 cups, but only 12 of them are going to be on average, I mean, this is what I do at night. I figure out how many cells that I'm getting on average per bar. I'm just a really boring person anymore. But I used to be exciting when I was young. All that's gone by the wayside. But if I know that I'm getting 12 cups pulled out into a cell, then I just play that out. And if I need more, I make another cell bill. So you're not really losing anything because you still have your old queen in a split over here.
How do you think it worked to have a starter, start them, and then pull the queen and put them already started cells in?
It'd work great.
You probably did.
It would work even better that way. But see, I have 11 bee yards in around my house within 40 miles there. Have 11 bee yards and I have 8 in South Mississippi. So I just go from bee yard to bee yard doing that, and I'm not likely to go back to the bee yards the next day and pull frame started cells and put them back in.
Now, on the sixth day, you said they're calved.
Yeah.
What do you take them out? What do you do with them then? Or do you leave them in there?
I put them in. What I call a virgin incubator, and that this is a pretty well. I wish I'd thought of this. Most of the cool stuff that I have, I stole the idea from somebody because I'm just not really that cool. But Ed Holcomb is the person that I stole this idea from. I'll give him credit. He would love it to know that he's getting credit for something. But it's a block of tuber core that's about that long. And I bored 5/8-inch holes all the way through it. And on the bottom side of it, I staple an 8-mesh screen all the way across the bottom side of it. And I put about a 1/4-inch standoff underneath it, like a rail or something, so that you have a 1/4-inch of dead space underneath on the screen side. Then I take those 6-day cells and put all them in those holes.
So you put one in each hole.
One in each hole. See, when they come out, they can't get to one another, but there's a screen across the bottom. I find a hive that's a pretty good hive, but the one that I'm sacrificing for this purpose, leave the queen in the bottom, pull a couple of frames of open brood up in the top and in the second super, and to draw bees up there, put a queen excluder between them, and I set this block on top of those bars, right on top of the two bars of open brood, and put a dead super up there, empty super on top. If the cells emerge as virgins, the bees will take care of them through that screen. And that way, if I have a cell that has something like black queen cell virus or something wrong with it, or if I've been rough with it, or you know, whatever, something wrong with the cell, I'm not wasting the mating nucleus, and I introduce virgins. And some people may not have good luck introducing virgins, but I do. I spray the hive with a little sugar syrup and take the virgin and just drop her in there, and she's good. Yes?
Can you tell us a little bit about how exactly you go about introducing virgin queens to get good results?
That was it. take a little sugar syrup and a little hand sprayer, and I'd spray the bees and let them start grooming one another, and I'd take this block, the virgin bank is what I call it, and I take it with me in a cooler and pull the cell and just put I use the little shoulder cups, you know, like the pen style grafting cups, queen cups, and they work really good. You just set down on that 5/8 inch hole. You pull that out. Well, most of the time the virgin is kind of disoriented in there because she's not used to the hole being open. And it'll take her a minute to even figure out that she can get out. But when she crawls out, I just catch her. Usually I'll mark her right then and just drop her on top of the frame in the mating nude. I use the full-size frame mating nudes.
And usually
see, a virgin has a gland in her abdomen that releases a chemical that repels the bees. And if you ever want to take this chance with one and have the opportunity, take a frame of bees out of a brood nest, and if you have a virgin queen, just drop her down in the middle of that, and wherever she lands, the bees will kind of go like that for a spot about that big around. And now, they don't last. I mean, within 30 seconds or so, they'll come back and they'll be licking on her and seeing who she is. But it's long enough that it gives the virgin time for the bees to kind of get used to her a little bit. That's the mechanism that virgins use to keep from getting killed when they come out in the hive and go to the queen, the old queen, and kill her. Most of the time, a virgin will go right through the old queen and kill her because the old queen never sees it coming. But that's how I introduce virgins. I was talking to a fellow in Alabama that was asking me about that. He was having problems with his queen cells, and we were talking about that last week. And I said, well, have you ever tried introducing virgins? He said, yeah, I had terrible success with it. That just didn't do any good at all. And we talked about that a few minutes, and I don't know if he's doing anything different or not. But all I know is what my observations, you know, that works pretty good for me, introducing virgins like that. In fact, I have as good a success by percentages just introducing virgins as I do just putting queen cells in, letting them emerge in the hive, as far as getting a mating queen back in the hive. Another advantage to that, there's two more advantages to it. One is it gives you about a week there that if your virgins emerge and you don't have mating nucs that you can put them in, it gives you about a week you can hold them in there. You don't want to hold them in there as virgins more than 2 weeks, or they'll begin to lose the instinct to fly and mate. But for about a week, you can wait on queens to come back and mating loops where they can start laying. You can pull them, do something with them, or you can wait on more bees to emerge or whatever. The second thing is it gives you time that if the weather forecast is just really awful for the next 3 or 4 days, and you know these queens are going to come out of the cells in the next 3 or 4 days, just hold them over. You don't have to put them in the hive, put the cells in the hive, and take a chance on them flying in high wind and being lost. So there's some advantages. There's also disadvantages, but those are the advantages. Yes, ma'am.
Can you comment on plane workers? I'm confused about what triggers that and how long it takes that to convert to plane workers.
Well, there's nearly always some land workers on hive, almost always. There's always somebody who wants to be a queen, and don't want to work. But usually, in a queen ride hive, the nurse bees will cannibalize those eggs, or that kind of mitigates the problem of a laying worker, because there's just a few. But where a laying worker begins to be a problem is when there's the thing that triggers it, triggers more bees to becoming laying workers, is a lack of juvenile pheromone or hormone coupled with a lessening of queen mandibular pheromone in the hive. And it's mostly the juvenile pheromone that triggers it. But the queen mandibular pheromone, when a queen is just gone, that will also trigger it. But there can be a queen in the hive that's just not productive, and if she's not producing, then there's no larva in there to give off the juvenile pheromone. If there's no larva, it doesn't matter if there's pupa. If there's no larva in there, then more workers are going to be stimulated to become layers. And to get rid of them, that's one of the toughest things that you can try to get rid of in a hive. There is a way that you can do it. If you need a mating queen, you need a newt, at least a 3 or 4 frame newt with a mating queen in it. You put that in the bottom deep on the bottom board where the foragers are going to be coming in to your laying worker hive. And on top of that, the deep where you have your queen right newt in it, you put a sheet of newspaper. Then you put the laying worker hive on top of that, but you make an upper entrance in the laying worker hive so that they can get out from the top easier than they can go through the paper. And what will happen, they won't go through the paper as long as they can get out the top really easy, and the foragers will all go out there and come back in the bottom, because that's where they're used to coming back to, is the bottom board. And it'll be 4 or 5 days before the hive will actually join. By the time it joins, all the foragers have become members of this queen ride hive down here, which was your three or four frame newt. And your laying workers are left up here with nothing to do, really. By the time they come through the newspaper, then everything's okay. The key to it is the upper entrance that they can get out of really easily. Like slide the top back where they can come out.
So once the larva stays through, it's gone. So now you only have cap,
yeah.
And have nothing. How long do you have to get a queen in there, do you think?
Sometimes it's too late right then.
So it's
an individual hive thing. Some hives will have a bunch of laying workers in it that have been laying for a long time, and that they just manifest, the problem just manifests itself once the larva's gone. Once the queen is quit or gone and the larva's gone, it's like that it's been kind of under the radar until then, and then it just blows up. But sometimes, in some hives, that actually is the trigger for workers to start laying. In those hives, you can put a queen in there and it'll work. But if you put a queen in a laying worker hive and they don't accept her, don't waste your money on another queen. So if they don't accept one, they won't accept any.
So I've seen this season five colonies, not just mine, for customers, there are cells with two eggs, and the queen's present with queen's laying. So is that an indication that there's a problem with her, or that there's a laying worker in there along with her?
There's probably a laying worker in there along with her, but sometimes a queen will lay more than one egg in a cell.
Is that something that will work itself
yeah.
out?
Most of the time, when you see that.
The queen don't want to go outside the cluster, so you don't want on the outside edge of it.
Yeah.
Especially. I've never seen that before.
And another thing, early in the spring when the queen just begins to lay a lot again, or if you have a queen that's just freshly mated and isn't used to laying eggs, either one of those, sometimes you'll see multiple eggs in a cell, and because it's like they're just starting up again or just starting their egg laying career, and they just don't really have a good handle on this stopping the egg process, you know, laying one in a cell. And also, with especially with queens that have just been mated and just started laying, once in a while, give them a week or so to get a hang of this fertilizing the egg deal, because you'll see a few drones in worker pattern a lot of times with freshly mated queens. Yes, ma'am.
Where did you draw the line then before you realize, well, this is a drone
in a queen? When there starts to be a lot of drones in worker size cells. If I'm seeing more than a dozen or so on the face of the frame, a dozen or so drones in worker cells, that's kind of concerns me. And if it lasts more than a week, that kind of concerns me. That indicates to me that she probably wasn't mated that well. Probably. Yes, ma'am.
Also, I didn't ever hear this before this year, but I heard people I really trust that a second year queen is better than a first year queen. I want to hear what you say about that.
Yeah. If she's well mated, yeah, definitely.
Why is she better than a second year?
Because she's used to doing it. The best queen that you'll get, number one, you raise her. That's kind of like my mantra. You will raise a better queen than you'll buy. But number one, you raise her. You raise her about this time of year, and she begins laying after, say, 1st of July. Sometime after the 1st of July, and she may not really impress you that much this fall. That's because the days are getting short. But next spring, she's already been accepted by the colony. She's already got this egg laying thing down pretty well. She'll start off earlier next spring, and she will impress you next spring. Because there's plenty of drones out there right now for her to mate with. The weather is, well, I'll say this, it hadn't been lately, but the weather is relatively stable, so she's liable to be able to stay out longer on the mating flight, and you're going to have a better queen that next year. I mean, you might say she's a one-year queen now, but a year from right now, she'll be a really good queen, and the next year, she'll probably still be a good queen. I have the majority of the queens in our hives are at least into their second year. Some of them are into their third year. And the queens that you raise are going to be better because it's going to be better mated because you're raising 10 queens that compete for the drones in the area. And whoever you buy them from is going to be raising 10,000 queens that compete for the drones in the area. It's just a mating quality thing. Yes?
When you start your queens, how often do you add brood or bees on that, or how long do you use it for?
I usually get most everything that I do on the cycle of the queen, on the 21-day schedule. And I can get three good rounds out of one cell builder, and then I might add some brood good after 21 days. 21 days, whatever's in there, was in there in the beginning, is done. It's gone. Yes?
I mean, you'll put your four cell wires in.
Yep.
6 days later, you pull them out and put four more in.
Yep.
But some brood will hatch to help make sure you always got one of these.
Yep.
You'll do that three times.
Three times.
So you can use one cell builder and get $150.
Yeah. I hope.
Yeah. And on each four cell bars, you put about 15, or you said 17 or something?
There's 17 cups on average. Some of them have 15, some of them have 20. I make my own stuff, so.
Now what do you use?
You just wouldn't believe how disorganized I am to be organized.
What kind of cups do you use? Do you like the
JZBZ? I use JZBZ cups. I use the ones with the shoulder. No, I use a wooden cell bar. I use the scraps that come off that hold package boxes together. And I drill holes in them that are, I think it's 3/32nds, I think. 3/16, I don't remember. It's 3 something. And that pin fits right in it. Now those holes will wear big, for the pins won't fit in them very well. In that case, you just take some beeswax and melt it and pour it down the bar. That fills the holes in, and that shims up the cups. Plus, it gives some wax on that thing. Bees don't typically produce all the wax that they use to make cells. If there's some wax there, they'll use that. If you want to do a cool experiment to prove that I didn't know what I was talking about, take some colored wax like you would roll for candles, melt it and pour it onto the bar, and then graft and put it in there, and you'll have some red and green queen cells. Because they'll use that colored wax to make queen cells. Like I said, I get bored.
They work better than you.
Yeah, they do. All the cups that the bees don't make a cell on, get a good light and look at them, maybe with a magnifying glass. Most of them they've cleaned out and polished. And you can reuse all of them that they've cleaned out and polished without even taking them off the bar. Just graft back into them. And, you can clean them, the ones that they have used, you can clean them up. It uses a drill bit that fits just right down in there to clean them up. You use a cloth or anything to just put the drill bit in there and twist it a couple of times.
Yeah. They're going away, well, not all the way to the bottom. You can fit the bottom.
Yeah, but it's brown. I used to do a lot of queen work with a fellow that he would take mineral spirits, pour it in a metal coffee can, put his used cups in there, slosh them around until all the propolis and wax melted off of them. And he would drain that and then put them in a wire basket and run them through a dishwasher. And he had good luck with it. I have a feeling if I did that, I wouldn't get a single sale. But he had good luck with it. But he did say that you wanted to do that. You wanted to get all that stuff off of the cells before you put it through a dishwasher. So the first time he did it, he just put them through the dishwasher thinking the heat would melt the wax and stuff off.
Mm-hmm.
And it did, but things didn't turn out too well after that. There was a lot of stuff stopped up that didn't need to be stopped up. The wax will melt, but then it cools off and sets up. Well, I hope that something has been said here today. That yes?
Another question.
All right.
The gentle cat.
Yeah.
Man Lake makes one.
Yeah.
I bought one 15 years ago, and I tried it for three different years, three different times. I could never get a sense of if you had any experience.
Yeah, I got one too. I mean, that was my second effort at raising queens. My first effort was just decoying a hive and cutting cells out. And my second effort was buying a Jenner kit and using that. And I got a few cells out of it, but it just, I don't know, it wasn't efficient enough for me. I was afraid that I was afraid I couldn't graft. I was intimidated by grafting. And now I know I shouldn't have been. I mean, grafting is just not a big deal at all. But I don't know. I tried a lot of different things. I tried one whole season raising queens with using get cells with the Jenner system. I tried taking the cups and putting them on a bar and putting syrup on them and letting the bees polish them and then putting them in the kit. I tried several different things, and I had a hard time getting a queen to lay eggs in.
I had no trouble getting queens to lay eggs in, because you let the queen out, you come back 4 days later, and they have the eggs gone, and they'd be full of honey.
Yeah.
I had that happen 4 or 5 times.
Well,
you pull them out, you put them on the cell bar, and put them in a hive, thinking then they'd hatch right in there, and wouldn't draw one. I had a guy who used to be a queen breeder, he looked at the kit, and he's already went like this. He said, I bet your queen, when she's lowering her butt down in there, and pinching it off, and she's putting that fertilized egg. He thought they were
maybe. Weak, you know? Maybe. I mean, that's a reasonable explanation. One of the funniest things I heard about a Jenner system, a friend of mine that was going to raise, he was going into the queen business in a big way. He bought him a Jenner kit. And he was telling me all how well that was going to work. Of course, it's easy to talk about how good something works, but it's harder to make it actually work. And my friend's name was John, and he called me about 2 weeks later. He said, I need to ask you something about this Jenner system. You had one, didn't you? I said, yeah. He said, do you ever use it? No, you can have it. Go on. He said, I don't want another one. And I said, well, how's yours doing? He said, I put it in the hive like I'm supposed to, and I opened that hole up, and I can't get that queen to go in there. I said, John, the queen ain't going to just crawl in there and lay eggs. You got to put her in there. He thought the queen is just going to crawl in there and lay them things full, I guess. But I think his would be pretty cheap if you wanted to buy one, too.
You don't use that. Yes, now you mentioned Jenner. Would you go over the differences on those points, what they mean? I know anything about those.
Splits. If you're going to raise a queen without grafting, split would be as in a wall.
What's grafting? I'm a newbie. I'm just
okay.
A couple months.
Grafting is when you artificially move a larva that's less than 3 days old. You take that
grafting.
Okay. But you move that larva out of where the queen laid the egg into the cup that you want to use.
You go through the differences.
Well, a split is like making a walk-away split, or that you just make sure that the queen, it really don't matter which one the queen's in. As long as you know there's eggs and bees and food, and those are the three things you got to have, eggs, food, bees. And it doesn't matter which one the queen's in, the one that don't have queen's going to make to make a queen. That would be the split. Hopkins method is you take a frame that has eggs on it and you score it in cross sections. And the reason you're doing that is so there'll only be a certain number of cells so that they won't make a cluster of cells all together, because they will. And you take a hive that does not have a queen in it, like a cell starter, and you take the frame and make a rack where it will lay flat, horizontal across the hive where the bees can access those cells. And you lay that in there and let them pull cells out of that comb. And then you cut the cells out when they're capped and use them. The somebody's going to have to educate me on the alley system.
The alley is cutting a strip of cells.
Okay.
And killing two in between each one and then inverting that underneath on the gravity frame.
Yeah, I've actually done that. I didn't know it was called an alley system.
It's got a couple other names.
Yeah. But just find a piece of comb that has eggs in it and cut that strip out and attach it to the bottom side of the frame bar. And like he said, destroy two out of three in a row so they'll pull those out. Jared Gibbs, we talked about that. The Miller method is to find a frame that has eggs on it and cut it in a V pattern like that. And the cell that they make will be on the edge of those and they'll be easy to cut out. A method that's...
I thought that was your talk no, there. I didn't realize no, it was
the use the Miller method. Isn't it easiest to take a fresh sheet of wax and
yep,
draw
cut
it out?
Cut it and let them draw it. Yeah.
And you can't draw off every second.
Yeah. If you're going to let them draw it, it's easier to do that. If you're just going to start from scratch, you can just cut it out and sort of make it that way. And there's a lot of different ways to raise planters. This is just a few of them. And none of them are wrong. If it works for you, use it. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, contact
info. Sure. Email KV is in Victory Williams at WK.net. Cell phone 970. Well, I'll start with area code 270. Forgot I'm not in Kentucky anymore. 970-1307. Don't be surprised if my voicemail box is full because I hadn't emptied it since about a year ago.
What was your email
again? KV Williams at WK.net. And you can probably get a hold of me through Chuck at the B Barn from Lono. Yeah, that's the quickest way. I answer Chuck's phone calls all the time. I'll answer a phone call from y'all's area code. I don't always answer 270 area code phone calls. Any other questions? Or comments? I'm fine with comments, too.
On the Ellie method, you got to make sure it's just wax and not plastic cell wax. It don't work.
Another method that's not mentioned there is the cell punch method. And you can take a little ring and solder it to a piece of brazing rod. And the ring needs to be about a half inch diameter inside. And put it in hot water. Before the ring will get hot, it needs to be water, not just heat it up with a torch. Hot water, and then find an egg and push all the way through. This also can't be plastic. Push all the way through, cut that out, and then attach that piece of comb with an egg in it to the bottom side of the frame, and then put it in a cell block. That's a cell punch method. But that works too. I mean, all of these methods will work. Whatever is the most efficient way for you to raise queens, that's how to do it. I just couldn't get the number of queens that I needed by just de-queening a hive and cutting cells out. Yes, sir.
Can you explain one more time on that virgin block you use, maybe?
Okay, it's you don't have to use a tuba core. I have a couple of them that are made out of these pieces of compressed styrofoam, like flowers, you stick artificial flowers in, and the hole needs to be 9/16, 5/8. Either one of those will work. But they bore a hole all the way through it, and the blocks two before I have 27 holes bored in them, and the hole goes all the way through. You put 8 mesh screen, staple it across the bottom side of that, and then you put a little strip of wood that's quarter to 5/16 thick on the bottom at the end of the tubing board, or at the end of the, or just anything to set it up on to give some standoff so the bees can get under there.
So like if you're just putting it here, so it's
like legs.
Yeah, so it's set up.
I couldn't figure out if you was putting it under the screen, above the screen, below the screen.
No, you put it where it's set up so the bees can access all those screens under there. And queen rod hive on the bottom, queen excluder, a deep with a few frames of open brood in it, and on top of the frame, fill it in with frames, the rest of the way with frames. And on top of that, that's where you set your virgin block and put an empty super on top of that with the lid. That'll give you about a week that you wouldn't normally have, that you can do something with queen. Yeah.
Do you think if we get nooks started now about this time of year, they're going to make it through the winter?
Sure.
Here in Illinois?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Feed them like crazy. That's the thing, you know. It takes lots of feed to get them ready for winter. Yes?
About how many nooks do you produce during the year?
It depends on the year. I mean, I produce probably 400 for myself, and then probably about another 800 for other people.
Okay. Then the next question, I'm doing probably 50, 60 a year on average for the last 5 or 6 years. Obviously, I'm doing something wrong because unless we go to 48-hour days, I can't figure out how I'm going to do all this. So I'm just questioning, can you give us a little bit on how you would increase production, I mean, of these nukes and that? I mean, what is it?
I'll tell you what I'm doing right now.
Okay.
We lost a lot of bees last year. The year before last, I had a guy working for me that sold a lot of bees. The only bad part of it was it wasn't his bees. all that's water under the bridge, but it put me way behind on our numbers of bees. And I spent one winter making equipment, and then we're still building up, trying to get back to the number that we would like to be, about 800. But right now, what I'm doing, I have 240 nukes right now that are all queen right. And next week, I have about 130 queens in a queen bank at my house, mated queens in a queen bank. And next week, I'm going to start splitting all those nukes. Right now, they're four-frame nukes, and I want to split them down to two-frame nukes and either put cells, virgins, or mated queens. I have a big graph coming out Tuesday. Should have somewhere around 200 cells. So I'll put either cells, virgins, or mated queens in all these splits. They'll be two-frame nukes. And that will immediately put me up to 440 nukes. Now, all of those aren't going to make it. Out of those 200 and something queens that I'm going to have, 130 of them are mated, they will make it. The other 100 or so, maybe 70 of them will make it. So it's going to leave me 30 empties. So I'll go back, and after these nukes build up, as soon as they get four frames in them, any of them get four frames in them, I'll start robbing brood and bees out of them and putting cells in them. I start with mating nukes, and I let the mating nukes build. When the mating nukes build enough, I split the nukes. And when I stop with all of that is around mid-August. And I need to stop at that time and start feeding. And if I'm not to the numbers that I want to be, I may go into mid-September, but the nukes in mid-September will go to South Mississippi before that I can put sugar on them and let them go over the winter. Yes, ma'am.
What kind of feeders are you using on the nukes?
Jars. I bore a hole about this big around on the top of all the nukes, and I just use a jar feeder, a quart jar feeder on them. Every other day. They'll take a quart every other day.
So
It is, but I don't have to do it.
There's the difference. No, I know.
Unless that you have everything in your bee yard the same size, you can't open feed because the big ones will rob the little ones. And if everything is the same size, then yeah, you can open feed then. But at our house, we have all sizes of stuff. Yes?
Well, news that you're putting in a two-frame news now, and if you come to your dirt, what kind of entrances are you using for
practice? Well, they have little bitty entrances to begin with. The entrance is about the size of my little finger. It's just a round hole I bored in the front of the hive. That's everything we have is homemade or rigged up, or you know, you'd be surprised what a honeybee would live in. Come to our house and see. You have a question, right? Well, no. Evidently not.
Do you make your four-frame loops for the standalone or two in a box?
Most of them are standalone. I have a few that are doubles. What I found with doubles is that they work pretty good if you have mated queens to put in them, just to build with a mated queen. But when I have used those for mating newts, the first queen that comes back and starts laying, all the bees migrate to that one. And I wind up with one that has a handful of bees and a queen, and they're wandering around like, what am I supposed to be doing here? And on the occasions that I've caught her, and caged her and put her in a hive, introduced her to a hive that had a lot of bees, they'd start off pretty good. But if I hadn't caught her, I mean, they had days to live. And that's just been my experience with using a multiple mating box. But if the queens both fly, both come back, and both start laying, everything works good. It's just on the occasion when one of them starts and the other one don't. That,
you make them out of plywood, or what do you
make? Yeah, I make them out of plywood, scrap wood, old pallets, and whatever I've got is what I use. I'm not particular. I'm cheap. I like to say frugal. The wife says cheap.
Plywood
seems
to hold up for a long time for you.
It's painted. The key is what you put on it on the outside, and I use, it depends on what I've got. If I've got outdoor latex, I use that. I just put a primer coat on it and put the latex on it. If I have an oil-based paint, I'll soak it in linseed oil, roll linseed oil on the wood, and then put the oil-based paint on it when it dries. That works really good, but it's more expensive, and I'm cheap. Well, I hope y'all have at least picked up something that you might can use, nothing else, a patty recipe. But I don't know. I never know what to say to people, because I know that if I say anybody can do this, that 2 years later somebody from the crowd is going to see me and say, you lied. I just can't make this work. But anybody is capable of doing it if everything works right. That's the best way to put it. Everything don't always work right.